This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to your podcast, New Books in Economic and Business History. I'm your host, Javier Mejia from Stanford University. And today I have the great pleasure to be with Martin Prack and Jan-Lutten van Sanden. Martin is professor of social and economic history at Utrecht University, and Jan-Lutten is professor also at Utrecht of global economic history. They are the authors of this book, Pioneers of Capitalism, the Netherlands from the year 1000 to the year 1800. I'm very happy to be with them. How are you, Martin, Jan-Lutten?
Excellent, thank you.
It's snowing, but otherwise everything's fine at this end.
Yeah, here as well, thank you.
No, I'm very glad.
We live in the same neighborhood.
Really? Oh, that's interesting. Really? I actually want to ask you about that. And if you don't mind, we can start with that. You have, very sweet comment in the acknowledgement of the book where you describe that you started your careers at the same time, right? A few decades ago. And so in a certain sense, you've had like parallel interests, and again, like the path of your career has been connected for quite a while. Would you mind if you tell me a bit about how that path has been constructed? How did you end up being the type of scholars that you are interested in the economic history of, well, the Netherlands, but of many other parts of the world? Would you mind to start with that, Martin? And then I would want to hear what you have to say.
Maybe
about that.
Maybe Jan Luiten will start with this question, and I'll fill in some of the details or correct him.
Okay, well, let me say a few words about my own career. I started studying development economics in the 70s. I wanted to change the world and solve the problem of poverty. That was the main driver of my choice of the study. And then I read the book by Wallerstein, and I became fascinated by the historical dimension of poverty in the world economy. And I decided to take on history as well as a second study. And as a result, I became an economic historian. I became very fascinated by long-term trends in the world economy and their explanation. And in 1993, Martin and I decided to join forces in a way and become both professors in economic and social history at Utrecht University. So since we have shared a chair, more or less, in economic and social history and have built up a nice research group. And we have actually also become emeritus professor. We have, in the Netherlands, you are supposed to retire at a certain point. So at this point in June last year, we had an official party celebrating our retirement, and now we have officially stepped down, and we are still working on many projects, but officially we are not the professor at Utrecht University anymore.
So maybe I'll add that we've collaborated for 30 years. When we applied for the job together, we promised we would write a history of capitalism in the Netherlands. And just before the retirement that Jan Luiten mentioned, we thought would be a good idea to deliver on that promise before people would take our pensions away because we didn't do what we had set out to do at the beginning. But the book is the fruit of 3 decades of thinking, talking, not only between ourselves, but also with the wider group of economic and social historians in Utrecht about, well, as Jan Luiten already said, improving the state of the world. Why is it that some societies prosper and others don't? And in a way, that's also the theme of the book, because we we discuss in the book why some elements of Dutch capitalism worked well and others probably did not. Well, we'll talk about that, I suppose, in the next 45 minutes. But that's what is behind the book. So not merely an intellectual interest, but also, well, if you will, a political interest.
I want to ask you more about your, I guess, your perception of the discipline in this 30 years, right? So you've seen many things happening in the field. And I guess here I'm interested both in economic history in general, but also, I guess, in the interest on the economic history of the Netherlands in particular. What things have changed since you were appointed jointly at Utrecht for the first time? What's your perception about the field in general?
Yeah, well, there have been many positive changes, I would say. One is that the field of economic history has been broadened enormously. 30, 40 years ago, it was about economic growth. It was about measuring real wages and things like that, which are still important. But via the institutional angle on things, we now study parliaments and democracy and religion and all kinds of institutions, marriage systems. So it has become much more inclusive in a way in terms of the topics that we think are relevant for explaining long-term social and economic development. And that's a very good thing. It has made our stories also much more interesting in many ways, I think. And the other big change has been the development, the rise of quantitative studies. And I also think I'm clearly a representative of that the change that it has also improved and clarified many discussions about the world economy in the last 1,000 years or so. So I'm also very optimistic about the changes that we have introduced in the field. When I was clearing my bookshelves, at least one of the bookshelves, because it's quite a problem to clear all your bookshelves at the moment, I found a book that I studied in the 70s as the first textbook in economic history, Tjuma, now almost unknown. And I was really surprised by the progress that we have made since the 70s in quantifying and understanding long-term economic change in the world economy.
So I should perhaps explain that I am not an economic historian in the strict sense of the word. I'm more of a social historian. And I don't think you can make quite the same claims for social history. But for me too, I was always interested in the political side of social history. This institutional turn in economic history has made it possible for the two of us to collaborate much more closely, because I was working on the social side of institutions. Jan Luiten was interested in the economic side of institutions, and the combination, well, we like to think has worked really well. But if you look at social history as a separate field, there has not been quite the same kind of progress that Jan Luiten was talking about. And one of the reasons is that, partly because of the cultural turn in social history, there has not been a theoretical framework, as is offered by economics, for the social history that is embraced by most practitioners of social history. So social history is a much more, diverse field, if you want to say it in a positive way, but you could also say that it is much more scattered, and that social historians find it difficult to work on the same projects.
What about?
So that's why I liked collaborating with economic historians.
Right. And what about the interest in both of these fields for the Netherlands? Has it increased in these last 30 years? Are we still equally uninterested on the Netherlands? Is it the other way around? I have the general impression, to be honest, after reading your book, that everyone should know more about the Netherlands, right? It's like such a crucial episode and economic and, well, social history as well, that everyone should have a very good understanding of what has happened in the Netherlands. But has that interest increased, or even like what was the landscape of interest 30 years ago?
So maybe I can kick off this one. It's very difficult to say if the interest in the Netherlands has changed a lot, but I do think that we as Dutch historians have been quite successful in making the claim that Dutch history matters for an international audience. And one of the reasons is, and this is not specific to social and economic history, but more to the Dutch academic landscape more generally, that it has become very international. So in the Netherlands, most scholars publish in English in particular. And actually, there's a big debate going on in this country about the number of academic courses offered in English. Some people are saying there are too many foreign students, there are too many courses in English. So in our department, you can do an undergraduate degree in history, both in English and in Dutch. And this is a quite normal situation in the Netherlands. So people publish a lot in English, and have been, the two of us have been really involved in that, in thinking very hard about the Dutch, about Dutch history in a sort of global perspective. And that's why, you will find much more information about Dutch history than, for example, about Polish history in English with international publishers.
Yeah, I agree, of course. The number of people working in the field internationally on Dutch economic and social history has increased enormously. When I started doing research, there were two economic historians working on in the international arena on Dutch economic history, and that were both were Americans, Joe Omokier and Jan de Vries. And Dutch scholars did not participate a lot in international debates. And that has changed enormously. So there are now 20, 30 colleagues who are working and publishing internationally on the kind of topics of economic and social history. So, but of course, this has been happening on a global scale. People working on China have increased even more dramatically. So perhaps we have been overshadowed by the growth in other countries, but the total output is much higher than it was 30 years ago.
That's very interesting. It's also very interesting to hear that then there's also a sort of pushback from like nationalist forces, apparently. I'm a true globalist, so I hope that doesn't expand. But let me get into the book, because I find it truly fascinating. And one of the interesting things about the book is that it's a very longer history of the Netherlands, right? So you start in the Middle Ages, and you do a very interesting analysis of how the Middle Ages were in the Netherlands and the particularities that it had. Tell us a bit about that. What type of place was the Netherlands during the Middle Ages? How similar it was to some of the most iconic episodes, right? People usually think about feudalism in France or England. How different was the Netherlands during this period? And I don't know if maybe Martin, you would like to start with this?
Let me say a few words and then I'll hand over to Jan Luiter, who has written the medieval chapters. First thing to keep in mind, the Netherlands as a country did not exist in the Middle Ages. There was nothing like it. It was very sparsely populated, and particularly the western part of the Netherlands that we now know as Holland were basically a big swamp with a barrier of sand dunes separating it from the North Sea. But it was very sparsely inhabited, and only during after the year 1000 did people move into the area and start to drain some of those parts and create, basically man-made land where gradually, of course, villages and towns emerged. And maybe there Jan Luiter can take over.
Yeah, and the Netherlands was clearly on the margin, in a way, of the European feudal system. The heart land of the feudal system was in the southern Netherlands, in northern France, in Germany. So the south of the Netherlands was part of that core region, but the north was more or less free from feudal influences, or freed itself after being conquered by Charlemagne again from feudal influences. So it was it could profit in a way from both systems. It profited from the early growth of the European economy, which was driven by feudal exploitation and urbanization and surplus extraction in the countryside in the classical way. And it also profited from the free trade, which was carried out by the Frisians in the north and northern part of the country. So this combination we analyze is an important reason for the ultimate success of the Netherlands in this period. It had the best of both worlds, the feudal world and the free world of the Frisians.
And so after a few centuries, you would argue that the Netherlands was eventually, or what eventually we're going to know as the Netherlands, was the pioneer of capitalism, right? What do you mean by that? What does this new system that you call capitalism and how was this like happening on the ground? Like, how do we see that happening in the Netherlands?
Shall I start? I think we do not claim that the Netherlands was the pioneer of capitalism. We claim that it was one of the pioneers of capitalism, and we do not go into the debate whether Italy was the first or other parts of the world were first, China, for example. But we do make the claim that it was a pioneer of capitalism. And the main features of the transition towards a capitalist economy are the rise of labor markets, capital markets, and markets for land, and of course commodity markets. So there are all kinds of indications that market exchange was growing very rapidly in the 14th and the 15th century. And at about 1500, we can clearly document, because there are very detailed sources about it, that more than 40-50% of the labor force is wage labor, for example. That is a very vital and capital market with low interest rates, 4-6%, and is normal at the time. And that land was transferred quite easily between Dutch inhabitants. So that's, in our view, are the main features of a capitalist economy.
But maybe to add to that, so one of the reasons why in these parts these markets emerged was the commercialization of the countryside. And so, of course, in these early European economies, the large majority of the workers are living and working in the countryside and not in urban economies. So this is one element in the bigger debate about the origins of capitalism. Was it, as Wallerstein claimed, a product of international trade? Was it, as Brenner claimed, a product of changes in the countryside? Or as Marx claimed, a product really of the industrial economy. But one of the things that happened was that in the western part of the country, that big swamp that was drained in the Middle Ages, there are ecological problems which have to do with rising water levels and soils which are becoming too wet as a result. And this created a transition from a, let's say, small-scale farming system where farmers were primarily growing to feed their own families, to one in which animal husbandry is the main source of income. And that, of course, operates through markets. So you get an agricultural economy that is very market-oriented. And as a result, on top of that, a lot of labor from the countryside is liberated, or you could say kicked out, and moves to the town. So you see commercial agriculture arising, and at the same time, the urban sector is growing very rapidly. And again, of course, that is a market-driven type of economy in urban environments. So it's a combination of institutional and ecological factors that is driving the process.
I mean, with this response, you're emphasizing the importance of the emergence of markets, but also you talk in the book about this sort of character that are what you call the civil society, right? What was the role of that? Like, what do you mean when you talk about the civil society? What was the role of this creature or entity in this process?
So the idea is that already in this period, ordinary people do have much more agency politically, socially, economically than your average history textbook allows them. And they are emphasizing how the nobility is holding firm on what happens in society. But what we emphasize is that both in the countryside, in villages and in towns, ordinary people are organizing themselves and are also controlling major institutions because there is so little central authority. So this is one of the reasons why we have a relatively positive evaluation of the feudal system. We say it created an institutional environment in which guilds, but also in the countryside, you have all these agencies that look after water management. That's a big issue in the western parts of the Netherlands. You have poor relief agencies, you have civic militias. All these institutions bring together ordinary citizens and they give them a platform to negotiate with the authorities. And as a result of that, there is a very strong tradition of local governance, which not only affects the political domain, but we claim also has a very positive role in the economic domain. It creates, let's say, structure where the authorities do not offer a public order. It incentivizes people to take economic risks, for example, because they know that the fruits of their labor will not be confiscated by the authorities. They are protected by these local institutions. So this is a very important part of our story indeed.
And also in other respects, the society in which capitalism emerges in the late Middle Ages is special in a way. There is a relatively equal balance between men and women. So gender relations are not really equal, but relatively the level of inequality is relatively low. And there is also no slavery, no forced labor. Slavery has disappeared. So in 1500, you find here a very complex society without slavery, which is also quite rare in world history.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Is this a result of, or how important, I guess, probably the right way of asking this, of the demographic and geographic conditions, the fact that you have not very densely populated area and probably labor was not abundant enough. So things like the formation of a strong slave system was not very feasible. Was that important in that story?
I don't think we give a completely satisfactory explanation why slavery disappeared from Western Europe. I think that's still a bit of a mystery. Part of the story is that the Catholic Church did not allow Christians to enslave other Christians. And if you are then living in the Netherlands within a sea of other regions which are all Christian, then it's very difficult to find the source of slavery, of slaves. So that's part of the story. Also, the disappearance of the coerced labor and the feudalism is a very gentle and very fast process. So the forced labor simply disappears. And the main political bodies, in a way, of this new society are the cities, the communes. And they also have a kind of ideology of freedom, of defending their rights against, for example, the king. And that also strengthens those tendency towards increased freedom, I think.
Let me ask you something about that. And I mean the role of the king, the crown, and in this context, right? Because eventually this empowered civil society that you describe is controlled by the Spanish crown, right? And what I thought is like the role of the Spanish crown has been so important in the history of Latin America, and we're quite concerned about the long-term legacies of this and economic performance. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Of course, like the duration of the exposure to this control and the practices were different. But I would like to hear from you about those impacts that resulted from the influence of the Spanish crown in the Netherlands. Did it matter at all that they were there at some point?
Absolutely, it did matter. But of course, you can't compare it to the situation in Latin America for the simple reason that the Netherlands were not a colony of the Spanish crown. And the Habsburg emperor, Charles V, became ruler of the Low Countries in a legitimate way. He was not initially seen as somebody. He was even born in the Low Countries, in Ghent. And so he is not considered to be a foreigner. He is not somebody who tries to colonize society. But what he did do, he made an attempt to centralize authority, because Charles was not ruler of the Netherlands, he was ruler of all the small entities that make up the Low Countries, almost 20 of them. So he was the Duke of Brabant, the Count of Holland, the Duke of Gelders, and so on and so forth. And so he collected a huge number of titles in his hand. The problem that he faces, well, there are two problems that he has. One is that he is fighting wars all over Europe. They are very expensive. So he tries to extract additional revenue. And the second problem he's facing is that more or less at the same time that he accedes to the throne, the Reformation is launched by Martin Luther in Germany, which creates an incredible amount of political anxiety in Europe, because there is a general assumption that any polity where the citizens or the subjects, if you will, are divided on this fundamental issue of religion is bound to collapse. So Charles and also his colleagues in other countries make huge efforts to re-establish religious homogeneity. For both policies, so extracting additional revenue and imposing religious homogeneity, he has to ride roughshod over all these local and regional privileges, rules, traditions, and so on. So he creates new institutions in Brussels that try to impose a sort of uniform governance throughout the whole region. And this then creates a very firm opposition, which ultimately leads to the so-called Dutch Revolt. And you have similar revolts in Spain and, you know, everywhere in Europe, but not quite uniquely, but quite, well, to some extent uniquely, in the Netherlands, this leads to the establishment of a new country. But it's, so, yes, there are similarities with what happens in Latin America, but at the same time, it is a very different context because these rebels in the Low Countries, they say, we have a contract with you, Charles, and later his son Philip. We are in a contractual relation. You promised to maintain our liberties, and you're not doing that. So you can no longer be our legitimate ruler. And that's where the struggle begins.
Yeah. In a way, the Spanish reign, from the perspective of the Dutch, started only with Philip II taking over the role of Charles V. That's 1555, I think. And then it takes 15 years or so before the Dutch start to revolt against this Spanish ruler. So they understood very quickly, within 15 years or so, that this was not the kind of regime that they could live with. And so that explains the Dutch revolt, which created this new country that Maarten mentioned.
Let me use that event to ask you about the regional heterogeneity in your story, right? Because frequently when people think about the Netherlands, they imagine this somewhat small, homogeneous place. But one of the things that you describe very well in the book is how there has been a quite different set of paths in different periods for the economic performance of these regions. What's the big story there? Like, what regions led economic activity at what points, which others lag behind? What could you tell us about that?
Well, in the Middle Ages, there is clearly the north is free, but it's not developing very quickly, and the south is becoming part of the Flemish Brabantine economy and is urbanizing relatively rapidly. So the center of the Low Countries is until about 1300, 1350 in the south. And then you see the emergence of Holland, which is changing everything dramatically, because between the Black Death and 1500, Holland becomes the new powerhouse of the Dutch economy. And from that point onwards until the present, even today, there is this contrast between Randstad, the urban region in the west in Holland, and the less urbanized parts of the country in the north, the east, and the south. So there has been a fundamental reorientation of the spatial structure of the Dutch economy in about the 15th century, I would say.
Now, let me bring into the picture the colonial era of the Dutch Republic or the Netherlands, again, to keep the terms that we're using. What was the role of colonialism? And now back again, slavery, but like played in a different context, right? So eventually the Netherlands expands and the world is one of the leaders of the European colonization of what today we would call the Global South. How important was that in this big story of capitalism emerging early on in the Netherlands.
Well, clearly it is very important, but it's also, we have to, in the book, we distinguish a number of aspects. And let me explain that. So what happens in, well, the decades around 1600 is that not only the Netherlands, but also the English are shifting their interests onto the world stage. Eh? Of course, so the European powers that have initially explored commerce with the non-European parts of the globe have been Portugal and Spain. They've also more or less officially carved up the world between them, and the Pope has given them a document that has legitimized that. But then around 1600, in the 1590s, the English and the Dutch are also interested in getting a slice of that pie. And for the Dutch in particular, this is partly induced by economic concerns, but also partly because they see it as an opportunity to hit back economically, but also militarily, at the Spanish Habsburgs. And we have to keep in mind that since 1580, Portugal and Spain are merged into a single polity. So this, from the very start, is a combination of warfare and profit, money-making. In the beginning, most of these efforts are directed at Asia. And the Dutch hold back in the Atlantic, more or less, for political reasons. After 1621, they also start to get involved in the business of Atlantic colonialism. But their initial attempts to set up a plantation economy of their own in Brazil are defeated by the Portuguese who have already settled there, and by strong attempts by the Spanish crown to kick them out again. And that's what ultimately happens. So the Atlantic efforts are not very profitable in the beginning. It's really only in the late 17th century that a new attempt is made, this time more successful, in Suriname to set up a plantation economy. Suriname is traded with the English against New York, which was known at the time as New Netherland, and, well, was a colony in jeopardy. So the Dutch get hold of Suriname and they create a slave-based plantation economy on the South American mainland. Already long before that, they were involved in the trade in humans, partly to supply those plantations in Brazil, but also partly to supply plantations run by the Spaniards in other territories in Latin America. In Asia, there are also places where slave labor is employed, but most of that is not, let's say, in productive activities. There is some, and we shouldn't overlook the importance of slavery, but it would be wrong to claim, at least that's the point we make in the book, that the so-called Dutch Golden Age is the product of slave labor. Yes, it contributed to the growth of that economy, but yeah, it became much more important at a later point.
Let's talk about probably the end of the period that you study in the book, and this probably connects with some of the research that you've done in other papers and books, and it's about the end of that golden era, right? So eventually what happens is that the UK becomes the lead of the global economy, and the Netherlands, in a way or another, lags behind. What's this story there? Is it an absolute decline? Is it a relative decline? Or and if that's the case, what's happening there, right? Is this story about innovation? It seems that so the takeoff of the UK is frequently associated with the technology of industrial production. And was there something that in the Netherlands constrained that type of innovation? I want to hear about that. And maybe Jean Luten, you can start with that.
Yeah. Well, to begin with, this is a normal part of the development of capitalism, that the centers, the core regions of capitalism change over time. And so the Golden Age was preceded by the Age of Antwerp, the 16th century, and before that, Flanders, Ghent, Bruges, where the center of the world of the Northwestern Europe. So you see a movement of changes of the spatial structure of economies, and the move from Amsterdam to London is obviously the next step. But then within England, you see another move from London to the north, which is the real region where the Industrial Revolution occurs. So this is, as such, it's a normal process. What we see happening in the 18th century is that there is still some economic growth, but less fast and less extensive, in the sense that it draws in a lot of new laborers from outside the region than in the 17th century. But there is no absolute decline. In the older literature, it was said that it was a period of absolute decline, but we find a very continuous economic growth in this period, until the French period, when wars and occupation really changed the picture dramatically. One of the this is clearly related to technology. The Dutch economy was based on peat as a source of energy, was based on wind power, but it did not use a lot of coal for industrial processes. So it did not have the same tradition of applying coal to industry. And its main engineers were working with timber. They were making big variations of windmills. But there was not an indigenous iron industry which produced more sophisticated iron machines. So it missed certain links to new innovative developments which were happening in France and in England. And therefore, it developed relatively late in the 19th century, its modern industrial basis.
Let me ask you one final question. I want to get back to where we started our conversation regarding how you perceive the field and your general impression of how your career was. And now I'm thinking, how do you think the future of the field is going to look like? So do you think that you're basically giving this like massive piece of work that says, well, this was the history of the economic history of the Netherlands and this whole period. What aspects of that history do you think that deserve more attention in the future? Where do you think that the research is going to focus on? What is the most promising areas? Are you optimistic at all? Do you think that with you out of Utrecht, this field is going to die? I want to hear about that.
Will you start, Martin, or shall I?
No, go ahead.
I'm always optimistic, and I think perhaps not in Utrecht, but we don't know, but the field will continue to develop. I think there are major challenges, for example, in the field of environmental concerns, biodiversity change, sustainability issues, that should be incorporated in the stories that we are telling as economic historians. So even broadening the subject matter more dramatically is one of the challenges of the future. I have already tried a bit to work, for example, on the history of biodiversity. And I think it's a very fascinating topic that deserves much more attention. So I think the process that has started with the new economic history in the 60s and the 70s of quantification and of broadening the subject that is being studied, that will continue, and it will make economic history even more fascinating than it is already. So I am really optimistic about that.
Are you also optimistic, Martin, about sort of like, I'm going to ask you also about social history, because you...
Yeah. So, well, there are two things that as a social historian, I'm a little bit concerned about. So one is that the social historians, as I already indicated in the beginning, so in the 1970s, when I was a student, there was a strong interest among social historians in fields like sociology and anthropology. So a stronger collaboration with the social sciences. And I feel that we have lost that as a result of the so-called cultural turn. And even though the cultural turn is no longer quite as strong as it was in, let's say, the 1990s, we haven't regained that connection. And another worrisome trend, in my view, is the drift, let me phrase it that way, among economic historians to become very model-driven. So in the Netherlands, economic historians work in history departments. But in the UK and particularly in the United States, economic historians work in economics departments, and there they are subject, at least that's how I understand it, to particular pressures, which you see reflected in the way quantification is applied to the past. And some of that quantification is driven in turn by the demands of econ journals. And it widens the rift between economic and social history. And as I explained, so Jan Nuiten and myself, we have tried to stay in touch intellectually over the 30 years that we collaborated. I have always very much appreciated the quantitative work that Jan Nuiten did, but he was always open to the sort of conversations that you see in the book. And it worries me a little bit that the opportunities for that might, I'm not saying will, but might diminish in the future. And this is partly because the social historians don't engage in the conversation, but it's also because some economic historians feel more or less compelled to withdraw from the conversation for the reasons I explained. So this is a concern that I have.
I'm glad that you bring that up, because it's probably a good way of celebrating what you've done in the book, which is a very nice synergy of economic and social history. It's also, I need to say, like a beautiful thing that it's also sort of celebration of like your joint career, and I thought it was very nice. So thanks a lot for writing the book. Thanks a lot for being here. I hope to see you soon.
Well, I'll be giving a paper in Berkeley about the book next month. So maybe we run into each other.
Certainly, we must.
Thanks for the...
Okay, thanks for hosting us.
Yeah, for the nice conversation. It also always helps... Also, us to explain again what the book is about. to realize what the book is about. So thanks a lot for that.
Thank you.